Hi, this is Dr. Mike with Jay Gunkelman, and you're listening to the Neuro Noodle Podcast.
Welcome to Neuro Noodle's Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring tech legend Jay Gunkelman. He is the man who has read over 500,000 brain scans. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The Neuro Noodle Podcast is supported by listeners and viewers just like you. And a special thanks to our gold and silver supporters. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neurosciences NeuroGuide Workshop December 10th and 11th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. And if you sign up now, you can join Dr. Robert Thatcher at his house for a pre-course get-together December 9th. It's going to be a blast. What a better way to enjoy winter by being in Madeira Beach, Florida, and earning up to 16 CEU hours. Sign up now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. MindMedia.com. Get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from MindMedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit MindMedia.com now. This is the Jay Gunkelman, the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans.
That's what's left of Jay Gunkelman. So,
welcome to Tucson City.
Oh, I see the mug.
You still got it.
That coffee's always hot with that mug on it.
Jay, it's so good to see you.
Dr. Mike Pierce, hereby known as Mike, welcome to the Neuro Noodle Podcast.
Thank you.
You are a chiropractor. You're a neurofeedback tech. You're a neurofeedback practitioner. You're a YouTube genius. What did I miss, Mike?
Well, I've been practicing chiropractic neurology for quite a long time now. I've been in practice almost 30 years, and I've been, you know, following various mentors throughout the years. And Jay, you are just the most precious one that I can speak of. And I can't tell you guys how much you've inspired me to make my YouTube channel, to get the message out there, to explain things to people. You know, the people just kept asking me, could you make it simpler? Could you make it easier for the layperson? Could you make it so I can explain it to my mom? So we just did that, and my students helped me, and my friends helped me, and my staff helped me. I had lots of interns. And so we just took everything we knew from the practice and everything that we knew from the patients and the extended families. Because, you know, when someone comes to you with a brain problem, the whole family has a problem. It's not just the person that presents. So the whole family would say, can you explain it to us? Could you dumb it down for us? Could you make it easier? Could you draw some pictures? And so, you know, I got some great educators helping me, and you know, you see the graphics and the production value on the show. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. I have to say, your graphics are much better than my bad art.
Anybody who knows that Jay draws art whenever he teaches, and it's really cool because it shows the point, but he does describe some bad art sometimes.
Well, I have to say my hand-eye coordination isn't perfect, you know, so my graphics are crude at best.
It's so plenty good. Oh, yeah. People love the screen shares. And by the way, it's turned on if anybody wants to have a poke. So Mike, you started off as a chiropractor. How'd you get into neurofeedback? What was the process there?
Well, I was a chiropractor and still am, but I had a friend who got in a terrible car accident, and he was in a coma. And we all went to the hospital to visit him, and I was a doctor, and I was looking at my friend in a coma, and I said, I don't know anything about this. How is that possible? Yeah. And all of us were there. I mean, there were hundreds of us that came in and out throughout the course of a month or more, and they were doing things to him. Some were giving him smelling salts and patchouli, and some were adjusting him, and some were were touching his feet and messing with the Babinski reflex and watching all the toes do things, and then his feet would sweat and turn puffy red. And I was thinking to myself, damn, this is not good. This can't be good for him. And I realized I didn't know what to do to help him, and I didn't know what to do to tell people to leave him alone. And so later on, you know, I was exposed to the Diplomate program in neurology in the chiropractic profession through the American Chiropractic Association. I took it, and I began to study neurology. And from there, I had always worked with psychologists and counselors that use neurofeedback and QEG. And so that kind of really dovetailed my interest in neurology, my interest in psychology. And then I started just taking on difficult patients, and there are people that were non-responders to neurofeedback, just like there are to chiropractic, non-responders and second opinions. And so I would scratch my head with everybody else and try to figure it out with my interns up at Northwestern Health Sciences University in Minneapolis. And then I taught for the Carrick Institute, and I taught for industry, I taught for supplement companies. But really, the short story is I just tried to solve problems, and we all tried to put our heads together.
So Mike, when a mom and dad call you up and say, my little Johnny needs help, how do you describe neurofeedback to the moms and dads and the brain scan and all that?
Well, I try to make it really simple, and I try to say we're not using drugs or surgery, or in this case, even electrical current going into you. All we're trying to do is teach you to respond to something that you don't normally know is going on. You got brain waves coming out of your head all the time. So we're going to pick them up, we're going to show them to you, and we're going to give you some signal that says, this is what we want, and this is what we don't want. And you'll learn, just like a dog or an animal or an infant or even a person that doesn't speak English, you just give them something, and the dopamine reward system just says, hey, something's better than nothing. So if there's a sound flashing or a visual image flashing versus nothing, they get that. There's also the negative feedback side sometimes when we show movies and when we show different signals and the movie slows down or turns black or reduces. That kind of feedback also helps. But they don't have to know that right away. We just tell them, look, we're training you to use a machine to tell you when it's happening and when it's not happening. And your body will naturally learn. You don't have to work at it. You can just sit there and it'll automatically happen. And they love that, especially my type A personalities. They're just, how can I make it faster?
how do you... Okay, if they're going through the training, that means you're training against something, a bar, right, a threshold.
Yeah.
How do you explain the database that you're comparing the waves of Johnny to what you're trying to train it to?
Well, sometimes I don't use a database, and sometimes I do. It all depends. I definitely have learned from Jay that databases can be very problematic, and so I have really, you know, over the years done a lot of both, and it depends what I'm doing. Because I do different kinds of neurofeedback, and I do different therapies. I don't just do neurofeedback. I do a lot of nutrition and a lot of lab testing and a lot of detoxification and a lot of neurology, a lot of rehab, a lot of diagnosis, a lot of examination, a lot of eye movements. So, but getting back to neurofeedback, when we do neurofeedback, I try to tell them, you know, whether our goal is to get toward a normal that is a group normal or a herd normal, and sometimes that's good, and it can be useful. And other times that's not our goal, and I'll tell them that's not our goal. We're aiming for this thing. And usually it's part of the informed consent as I try to explain to them before they even agree to it. I say, look, you know, I think this might be a direction to go. What do you think? And we'll discuss it, and we'll talk about what our goal is, and maybe we should make this more over here, make this less over here. What do you think about that? And then the patient, if they're smart, will say, well, what'll happen if we're doing it right? What'll happen if we're doing it wrong? And I'll tell them, I got a plan for those too, because I ought to. And I always tell my students, you better have a plan for when things go wrong, because they will. They will.
You try to get people out of comas. From what I've heard from Jay, that's not a fun business to be in. Could you get into that a little bit?
Yeah, I took the coma training in Europe and in the United States and began to become a leader of coma teams in Minneapolis, and I worked on several different coma teams. And we are not always successful. Patients do die. We lose them. We don't kill them, but they do die. It's serious business. It's not what the average chiropractor does. I led a team of interns and doctors in Minneapolis, and I've had lots of failures. You don't do serious work and not fail. And I think it's really important for people to understand that I make mistakes every day, but it's because I dare to make a hypothesis about what is wrong with the patient. And I might make 8 or 9 hypotheses about one patient, and I'll find that 2 or 3 of them are wrong. But the process of being a clinician is to test those hypotheses and say, that's wrong. But it takes several weeks or months to figure out that it's wrong, because you use a clinical trial to figure out that it's wrong. And that's what clinicians are supposed to do. Now, researchers don't like that. They go nuts because they say, oh, it's unsafe and it's dangerous and it doesn't give you the truth. And I say, yes, yes, yes. But I have an ethical obligation as a clinician to really pay attention to trying to get the patient better and make a hypothesis about what is wrong with them, because we don't know everything.
Now, the difference between Jay did and what you're doing, Mike, I think, Jay, you worked with veterans who got pretty pissed at you when you brought them out. And I don't
yeah.
know.
We woke up 27 out of 33 who had been in a coma over a year with a Glasgow coma scale less than 8, which basically means there's been no reaction to anything, pain, sound, whatever. They're just not responsive at all. And that's what a layperson might consider a full coma, as opposed to like locked in. Some people know what locked in syndrome is, or kind of a light coma where they respond to touch or something. These people are just a slab of people. They're not there. And 27 were brought out. The process was a brutal process. We don't tickle your feet with feathers and whisper in your ear, wake up. You know, that doesn't work. Somebody else already tried that kind of stuff, you know, and were unsuccessful. So Kessler Hospital in New Jersey would allow the study. It was difficult to get the IRB approval, because what's informed consent when the patient's in a coma? And if you ask the family, sign here and I'll wake up your grandma, I mean, that's, you know, coercive consent, and that's not real consent. And if you go ahead and assume, okay, if your, you know, second cousin says okay, then now it's okay, and it's ethical, you know, you're deluding yourself. But let's say you think it's a fine thing to do. Well, when you wake up 27 people, and a third of them are really quite upset with the process having been brought back. They're not happy to be back. Most of them don't really remember the process of coming back. You know, that they're treated with medication for a few weeks to excite excitatory chemistry and extinguish inhibitory chemistry, so that if the nervous system gets an input, it's going to have a big reaction. And then we strap stimulators on the hands and feet and turn them up to a point of ridiculous level of stimulation. You know, a median nerve stimulator, you get a little twitch in the thumb. That's a good response. If you turn it up too much, you might get the hand to twitch a little bit. If you turn it way up, you get the whole arm jerking. Well, both feet, both arms are jerking around. It looks like the person's having a convulsion on the table with the stimulation. If you look, you get a 40% increase in brain metabolism from all of that, which is kind of what the reason to do it is. You're trying to stimulate the brain into being active. And most of them woke up during that. There were some that woke up with a C2 stimulation, which is C2 is basically the top of the spine at the back of the neck. And the C2 stimulation goes directly into the brain. Kind of like having a cattle prod stuck into your brainstem. And these are aggressive attempts at waking people up. When they come to, they're usually vocal, not yelling thank you, but more like F you, you know, and swearing and screaming and. But they don't really remember that very much. That's all cloudy and kind of fades out of their conscious awareness after they're back. But the ones that are back and solidly back, you know, if you could predict which ones were going to be upset, it'd be an easy thing. Oh, yeah, he's missing both arms and, you know, he's not going to be a happy camper if he comes back. Well, people with really severe physical problems like that were just as happy as a lark to be back. So you can't look at them and go, oh, well, yeah, you know, he's a real mess. I don't know if we can bring him back and have him happy, because being a real mess didn't predict unhappiness. One fellow had lost IQ points, and he was normal. It wasn't like he was a stupid person in the state that he came back in. He was conversational, you know, as a relatively normal level of intelligence. But he had been awfully sharp, and the loss of his, I guess, sense of self, of being the bright guy, somehow that was more than he could take, and he attempted to do himself in repeatedly. So, you know, I can do other things. We just showed that it was possible, that the technical possibility, the feasibility of coma recovery. And, you know, it's entirely feasible. It's relatively effective. And in fact, in one circumstance, not in that study, but in one circumstance, there was the use of the technique, not waiting for a year and getting an IRB approval and all of that. But if you remember, there was a mine that collapsed, and all the miners kind of sequestered themselves in a little, they taped off an area, you know, trying to keep all the good air in, and they made it quite a long time. There were a lot of them in there, but when they finally got to him, there was only one person left alive, and he was in a coma. They scooped him up, ran him to the little local hospital, Sega Mine. The Sega Mine group brought in this group from New Jersey. They woke this guy up in a day. And, well, he wasn't as far gone. I mean, there were still some crude reactions and things still there. I mean, he was more present than the people that had a Glasgow Coma Scale less than 8 for over a year. So he popped back. And, you know, he was conversational. You could tell he was a little, I don't know, it wasn't just shell shock of having been back. He was a little stunned, sort of, in his presentations. So, I think going over and coming back is quite the experience. So being a bit stunned, I can understand myself having been over and back a few times. So the first few, you're a bit like the deer in the headlights when you come back. So,
Mike, what's your take? What is a coma? And then, do I need to fill out paperwork at, you know, beforehand to say if I'm missing two arms, don't take me out of it or bring me back out? Is there? I'm serious. Is that part of the do not resuscitate?
Yeah, it can be part of those orders. You can make them official. You can put them in there. In fact, I've been named by a few people to be contacted if somebody gets into one, and I don't love that. But there you go. Take a look.
The physician order for life sustaining technology, POLST EMT DNR. With that form, if you go down in public, and you happen to have a little warning device on you, a medic alert, or they go to your wallet, or if you have a tattoo that says EMT DNR, they'll look. They have to actually see the document. Because, you know, you could get a tattoo and then change your mind, and damn, that tattoo is still there. You know? So they want to see a current form, basically. But it means that they can't resuscitate you. If you go down in public, they'll pump you back up and stick things in you, and by the time you're in the hospital, you're on the slippery slope already. They've got you back breathing again, and you know they're trying to keep you alive, and it's against your will. You wanted to be left to nature's course, and you know I have a PLST EMT DNR myself. I've got so much wrong with me. For God's sakes, if I go down, what the hell are you trying to save?
Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neurosciences NeuroGuide Workshop December 10th and 11th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend. online or in person with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. And if you sign up now, you can join Dr. Robert Thatcher at his house for a pre-course get-together December 9th. It's going to be a blast. What a better way to enjoy winter by being in Madeira Beach, Florida, and earning up to 16 CEU hours. Sign up now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops.
One more piece missing and there won't be anything here to save. You know?
So you carry a bottle of champagne with you in case that happens.
You know, I'm fine with either way. I'm happy to be here. I'm not like looking to duck out and, you know, disappear or something. But at the same time, I've been over and back enough times to not worry about it. And you know, I've got a lot wrong with me. I mean, the brain tumor, when we found that, I called the doctor who had told me one more thing wrong with you, be a monster, and told him about the brain tumor. He said, I don't know what to say. I said, yeah, you do, Mike. Call me a monster. Oh, don't you remember? So,
you've been wrong for 20 years, man. You got another 20. Who are you kidding?
It's been 30 years since the brain surgery, and they give you 10 as your 50% survival. And it's an accurate estimate, actually. There are some things where their estimate is an old estimate based on old therapies. Lung cancer, for instance, the average is 10 months from the date of diagnosis for stage 4. And nowadays, you can get multiple years with some of the current treatments. So, you got to have an accurate current estimate. Well, with no pituitary, that 10 years is an accurate estimate on the average. If you're a female, that's an overestimate. The women have a lot shorter probability. It's very brief. Apparently, their hormonal systems are a lot more difficult to imagine that, you know.
Really?
If you're studying in biology, you think the Krebs cycle is difficult. Go ahead and try to figure out the female reproductive systems feedback cycles. And holy moly, you know, it's a miracle that anything ever gets born. You know, so
yeah, that's true.
So Mike, I believe you're the first chiropractor. I know you do other things, but technically you are also a chiropractor.
Yeah.
And this is mental health. What are the things that you do as a chiropractor to, let's say, relieve stress, or clients come to you? How can a chiropractor help?
Well, really, we have always kind of existed as a last resort. And unfortunately, some of us have made claims that are not substantiated, but that doesn't eliminate the fact that there are outliers. There are cases where somebody has something wrong with them. You go through all the standard treatments and they don't work, or they work marginally, and then or there's an objection to the therapy. The patient says, I don't want the toxicity, or I don't want the side effects, so I'm not going to do it, or I'm going to limit the dose. And then somebody comes along and adjusts them, like the first chiropractic patient, Harvey Lillard. Yeah, he's a guy who was bent over in a staircase and he was lifting a toolbox and he felt a pop in his back. And he was mostly deaf after that. And then, Daniel David Palmer, who was a magnetic healer at the time, said, well, you know, let me check you out. So he put him on a bench and checked him out and found a vertebra. We think it was an upper thoracic vertebra out of position. It could have been the atlas. We don't know. And he had him face down and he pushed that bone back into position, he thought. And there's a lot of problems with that idea, but he did it and it worked. And we don't fully know why, but we have a lot of theories, and the theories have some really good physiology behind them. And they mostly involve the autonomic nervous system, which is at the core of the coma recovery program that I did too. The whole idea of autonomic coverage of watersheds, which Jay talks about quite a bit, there's not only the nerve cells that fire in a given area of your brain, but there's the watershed of the blood flow that supplies and drains that area. And that's a system that's integrated but different. And it has its own rules, and it's different from patient to patient. There's biochemical and genetic and anatomic individuality. So to answer your question, what we do in chiropractic is we try to figure out all the other stuff that could be done with regard to affecting the brain. So that means adjustments. That means, in the old days it was heliotherapy, go sit in the sun. It was food and diet changes. It was exercise. It was all manner and form of chiropractic adjustments, from the top-down atlas ones to craniosacral to the lumbar and sacral ones, like the Logan Basic Method, which was made famous in the Logan Method, the Thompson Drop Methods, the Activator Methods. All these different methods were used. We also did supplements and diets. We did keto. We were some of the first to do ketogenic diets, because that's been around for hundreds of years. I mean, thousands of years. The ketogenic diet's been described throughout history, using more fats and less carbs for seizure disorders. We've also used things like brain exercises. The functional neurology profession really looks at brain exercises that target a specific area of the brain, like all kinds of things. It could be stroking the face with a soft brush, a makeup brush, on one side of the face and one particular nerve for an autistic child, and it calms them right down in some cases. Not all, because each person is unique and different. And you look for evidence of what's happening in the evoked potentials that you're doing to a person. Because every time you touch a person, you're eliciting an evoked potential. Even if you're not measuring it with an ERP, you're eliciting an evoked potential whenever you touch somebody. Even whenever you talk to somebody, you're eliciting an evoked potential. And so we might do eye movements. We might do tongue exercises. We might do gargling. We might do clicks in one ear or another ear. We might do really interesting hemifield stimulation, where we might stimulate the temporal lobe on the opposite side with large flashing checkers or small flashing checkers to activate the parvocellular or the magnocellular portions of maybe the what or the where system, depending on whether we're using the dorsal or the ventral visual stream or auditory processing. There's a whole bunch of stuff we can do, and we do that based on science and physical examination. Now, we don't have a ton of validation to say that this exercise fixes this disease and this diagnosis and this ICD-10 code. And I'm sorry, but you know what? When your mother is sick and you call somebody like me, you want somebody that uses science, and that's us.
Let's talk food, because you're a food guy. You know about food. I know about food too, cheeseburger and French fries. But let's talk about marketing and food. And I got to see if the wife is around, but is there really such thing as gluten allergies,
or is that
an anxiety that turns into glutens? Has that always been around? Talk to me. Let's start with glutens.
There are several layers of gluten to unpack, and the first one is, experts like Bonden and Shiva will describe how there are different breeds and different hybrids of different grains that have not been the same. And in the past, some of them were much healthier than the ones that we've grown today. So the different kinds of grains and the different kinds of genetically modified organisms and the different kinds of life that have been created are also differently antigenic. So that's one thing, which is, what is wheat? Which wheat are you talking about? Which dairy are you talking about? Which corn are you talking about? So that's the first one. The second one is the layers of the immune system and the brain sensitivity. And I think the most sensitive would be the celiac disease. And we were taught in school that celiac disease is, that stabbing pain you get in your gut as soon as you eat wheat, and it's a hallmark for celiac. But most people don't have that. Now, the gold standard for that is to do a biopsy of the intestine and to say, hey, there's actually celiac disease here. But about 98%, 99% accurate is the antibody test. So we do an antibody test, and we look for, antibodies to alpha-gliadin and transglutaminase, and if one of those are positive, we tell you you've probably got celiac disease. Now, there's a couple of genetic tests that will allow us to test HLA-B 2 and 8, HLA-DQ 2 and 8, which are genes that determine whether your problem is more brain or more small intestine, because there's brain celiac and there's gut celiac. You can have that. You can have the gene for it and not the antibody, because the antibody hasn't turned on yet in your child. And later on, it turns on after exposure or stress or a combination of the two. And maybe you have the gene, but it never turns on. And so that would be, a different kind of celiac, but still a genetic and antibody-based. And then there's sensitivities that are not so much celiac disease as just sensitivities to IgG and IgA antibodies and IgM antibodies. Not so much an allergy, which is IgE antibodies, And so those are called sensitivities. So you've got allergy sensitivity, celiac disease, the genetic component, and then you've even got the lectins. There's a lectin component to gluten and wheat, which is not exactly an antibody reaction because you don't require antibodies for gluten, for lectins, which are little proteins. Lectin means to choose. It's a hook. And this protein hooks onto your intestinal lining and attaches to it, and it causes mucus, it causes inflammation, it causes acid formation release nearby the cell. The cell thinks it's under attack because something latched onto it like a submarine. You know, if something clanks onto a submarine, it thinks it's a mine. Likewise, if a cell of your intestine gets clanked onto by something, it thinks, oh, a bacteria must have infected me, or a worm, or some kind of parasite. So that lectin, there's something called wheat germ agglutinin, WGA, and wheat germ agglutinin doesn't require any antibodies to trigger a response. And it actually messes with the insulin receptor and causes insulin resistance. So you can gain weight, you can become diabetic, you can become pre-diabetic, all without any antibody test being positive. So you would be antibody negative, and you would walk around saying, I had my food antibody testing, and I don't have any, and I'm fine. And I wouldn't even call it a false negative, because it was a lectin you were looking for, and lectins don't require antibodies. So there's several layers of what can happen with gluten. It's a great question you've asked, Pete.
Our food supply is also not historic food supply. You think oats. Well, oats, they've been around forever. I mean, what the hell can be wrong with oats? Well, in the harvesting of oats, you want oats to be dry and essentially dead as a plant. The green growing part needs to be dead. So they spray the entire field with Roundup, which is banned in Europe and you know, problematic at best. I mean, it's an awful circumstance to be exposed to Roundup. And you know, there's lawsuits and all of that going on. But if you look into the news over the last few years, you know, little round oats that you eat in the morning, you know, the oatmeal and things such as that that you eat, they've been testing it. Then the Roundup is still in it. So there are people that have GI reactions, not necessarily just to the gluten-related grains, but to what's on them. And my mother was fine with all wheats and all of that all of her life until she was, you know, like 80-something years old. And at that point, she started to react really quite badly to anything oatmeal. And I suggested that they basically try a cream of wheat instead of oatmeal, because they don't kill off the wheat the same way before they harvest it. Mm-hmm. And you know, she had a dietary a replacement that was okay to her, and it helped. But you've got to be aware that gluten sensitivity may not be necessarily just to the actual seeds, but to what's on them. Yeah. And it's unfortunate that you know, chemistry is not being controlled more accurately. You know, Bayer bought out the Roundup, and they replaced it with a Roundup equivalent that's equally toxic. So, you know, but you're, you know, oh, we won't use this toxic one. We'll use this toxic one.
Yeah.
Yeah. The unsaid statement, you know, and if there are ways to end up killing off green material that you want to kill off using clove oil and a soap mix. The soap basically is a surfactant to get it into the plant, and the clove oil is enough to kill off the plant. And there's nothing, quote, toxic to the extent that Roundup or any of its modern day equivalents are. But it's hard to get a governmental entity that string all the roads in your town to knock down the median's growth with something other than historic commercial product. And there are places still spraying things that shouldn't be sprayed. So it's unfortunate.
Yeah, Jay. Stephanie Seneff wrote a book called Toxic Legacy about that, and it's absolutely true. I test people for glyphosate in urine with Great Plains Laboratory and right here in the U.S. in Kansas City. And you're so right. It's the toxic legacy that we're exposed to is horrible. I followed your career and some of your exploits in environment, and I wanted to ask you, you know, how did you get from all of your environmental science interests and toxicology interests into EEG, or which came first, and how did you do that? Because you've done so much with the world of environmentalism and toxicology and standing up to the man. How did that all happen as you grew up and as you formed your early career?
I've always been easily distracted by other topics. And if I'm interested in something, I'm going to drill down on it. And environmental matters have interested me because they've affected me. The little town I lived in, Crockett, California, had a refinery about 6 minutes at a 10-mile-an-hour wind upwind from us. So we were downwinders and we received 250 something tons of a toxic substance called catacarb, which is a catalyst used in refining. And they dumped that for 16 days and didn't tell anyone. And most of the people in the town were sick. Now, when you live in a town of 3,200 people and most of the people get sick, it's hard to miss that. You know, and there were a few hundred that were extremely ill. We negotiated a settlement with the refinery, and they put an environmental specialist medical clinic in the town to help people. And they spotted my rash on my arm and actually did a blood test and told me about my brain tumor, that I owe my life to that toxic waste. But they still pissed me off because they toxified my town and my neighbors. So I had to figure out a way for us to know they were dumping stuff when they didn't want to tell anyone. So how do you do that? You know, so I'm kind of crazy. And I thought, well, let's surround the refinery with laser beams. And if the chemical breaks the laser beam, we'll get the chemical fingerprint of the chemical. Now you have to have an infrared and an ultraviolet beam because one picks up stink and one picks up toxic. And you got to pick up toxic because it's toxic. And people are going to complain about the stink, so you got to pick up that too. And so with a couple of lasers on the upwind and a couple on the downwind side, and we invented the first refinery-based laser pollution detection system in the world. And that was about 30 years ago. And now for the first 25 years, everybody said, well, you're crazy. And I said, that aside, what about these lasers? You know? It turns out that about 6 years ago or so, they convened a panel of experts from UCLA, California environmental groups, all the advisors that they could get together. What's the best way to monitor refineries? Because refineries have had some problems. You know, if you got a refinery, it'll be a problem eventually. It's inherent to the very dangerous industry. And to err is human, and somebody's going to make a mistake, and something's going to go bad at some point. And when it goes bad in a refinery, it can go really bad. So they got advice, and the advice from the group was basically what we made 30 years ago now, 6 years ago, they said, now that's state of the art. Suddenly I wasn't quite the fool. But at first they said, why are you using physics to detect chemistry? You know, we could build a little shed on the fence line of the refinery with a pump that sucks air through a little hole on the wall and run through a little gas detector and tell us if there's something being released. Yeah, but it's got to hit this little hole. I've got a kilometer long beam, and all it has to do is break the beam. You know, and if you've got a beam of clean air that you've shot, and you know the spectra of the clean air, you subtract that spectra from this other spectra. Geez, it sounds a little like EEG. You're dealing with spectral comparisons and normative databases and R-squared comparisons. I mean, it's all the same kind of stuff with a different frequency band. And so I basically ended up having the world's first built in the local refinery, and now they're mandated in every refinery in California. So, but I put the design in public domain, so there's nobody that can patent the design. Thus, it can be adopted without having to pay some idiot the gigantic royalty.
The NeuroNoodle podcast is supported by listeners and viewers just like you. A special thanks to our gold and silver supporters. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neurosciences NeuroGuide Workshop December 10th and 11th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend: online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. And if you sign up now, you can join Dr. Robert Thatcher at his house for a pre-course get-together December 9th. It's going to be a blast. What a better way to enjoy winter by being in Madeira Beach, Florida, and earning up to 16 CEU hours. Sign up now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. MindMedia.com. Get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from MindMedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit MindMedia.com now.